Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, Joel. We have a listener question Monday. This is where we field questions from our listeners. They send in a voice memo, and we'd like to answer them here on the show, man. This episode, we have some questions like rounding up investment apps. We're going to get to that. We're going to talk about buying property to build wealth, as well as squeezing as many benefits out of a credit card that you possibly can without hurting your credit score, plus two others. I'm looking forward to all five of those questions today.
Yeah, me too. Listener questions, so good. We got some really, really good ones this episode. But before we get to that, Matt, I saw you got some new Halloween decorations this year.
Yeah. Did you see our big night out front? We finally got that outside.
I did, yeah. Bloody neck, I saw.
Kate added that because during the day, the night doesn't look very scary. At night, very intimidating, right? You got this big dark figure. He's kind of got the helmet on and stuff like that. But during the day, I'm like, does it just feel like we're at medieval times? but I'm glad you brought that up, though, because we picked that thing up this past winter on the side of the road, man.
You are like the
it was a curb alert.
I feel like, I don't know, I've never known anyone who picks up as much.
We score some really good stuff.
You do. You get some good stuff on the side of the road. And I think most people are apprehensive to take stuff from the side of the road, but you and I have occasionally gotten good stuff, or I'd say I occasionally have gotten good stuff. You almost always get good stuff on the side of the road.
You've got to keep your eyes peeled, and that's one of the benefits.
Now you've got a giant night that you've got to store away after Halloween's over.
Well, so that's the thing. We saw it. So actually, Kate saw it first, and she was like, hey, and this was after a school function. It's in the winter, last winter, and so it was really dark, too. And she was like, hey, let's drive by this one house, because I'm pretty sure I saw a knight propped up against their fence, like they're going to give it away. And sure enough, we get up to the house, and it was out on the curb, like next to the street. So we totally picked it up, man. We couldn't see what was on it, like if it was gross or anything. We just grabbed it, threw it in the van. Definitely one of the benefits of having a minivan is being able to pick up something large like that.
That's
throw it
true.
In there. It's like 6'4". He's like your size.
Minivans, yeah, they really are. Like, people don't understand how glorious they can be when it comes to hauling stuff.
They're very good. But yeah, I was curious on your thoughts on curb alerts, kind of with a pandemic going on. You know, I think had we seen that on the side of the road now, maybe we would have hesitated a little bit. I think we're a little more careful about picking things up. But at the same time, I don't know. I feel pretty good about stuff in our neighborhood. Like a pillow. If you see a pillow on the side of the road, you probably pick that up.
Right, exactly.
I would totally put that in my bed.
Love sleeping on free pillows that I find on the side of the road, especially if it's been rainy the last couple days, you know. They're really nice then.
No, it's all juicy.
One of my friends, she picked up a chair on the side of the road and there were bed bugs in it. She didn't realize it. And it just created this infestation in her house. And it was just this horrible saga. So, I am willing to pick up some things, but I'm pretty choosy about the things that I am willing to bring into my house. Like I got some good soccer cleats.
Maybe
6 months, 8 months ago.
Did we share that on the show?
I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah.
But yeah, like
for Selma.
Two awesome pairs for, for Selma now and for Selma later. But it's one of those things where I'm probably a little more particular, and I don't know. I don't know if COVID's changed that or not, but I think I'm just generally a little apprehensive unless it looks like something that has really been taken care of.
Or if you can just hose it down, maybe let it bake out in the sun. I feel like the sun and a little bit of wind, I feel like all that can kind of like naturally disinfect it.
There we go.
Maybe. I don't know if that's science or...
wind. Nature's disinfectant. Exactly.
That's my hippie granola side coming out a little bit.
There we go.
Just needs a little bit of sunshine.
All right. Well, let's move on to the beer that we're having on the show today, Matt. This one's called Swoon Units, and it's by Fonta Flora Brewing. They're out of North Carolina, and this is blackberry beer, and we'll give our thoughts on this one at the end of the episode. But for now, let's get on to listener questions. And if anybody out there wants to have their question featured on an upcoming Ask HTM episode, we'd love to have it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. Simple instructions there for how you can submit your voice question for us to take on a future episode. So let's get to those questions for today, Matt. Listeners who did follow that process, the first question we're taking on today's show is about paying points to get a lower rate on a mortgage.
Hey, Joe and Matt. This is Kirk from San Diego, and my wife and I are planning on buying our first home very soon, and I had a question about buying points from my lender. I was planning on using my VA loan and going with zero money down, and the loan would be for $575,000 at around 2.75%. PITI with HOA would be almost $3,600 a month. So in 30 years, not factoring in the rise of taxes or HOA, we would be paying a little more than $1,293,000. If we put in $8,850 to buy points with my lender, we would get the rate down to 2.25%, which makes our monthly payment about $3,440. And in 30 years, it would mean we pay $1,238,000. The difference here is about $55,000. So does that kind of mean we're effectively investing $8,850 to gain $55,000 in 30 years? I think that's about a 6% compounded rate of return. I know it's a very simplistic way of looking at it because I'm not factoring in if we paid off the mortgage early, decided to sell, or accounting for taxes and HOA going up. So what do you guys think? Would it be worth it to buy a lower rate? Anyway, thanks for your time and keep up the great show.
All right, Joel, let's answer that question. First of all, a VA loan is a great perk if you have served in the armed forces. You know, this is a great question.
It's a great perk, especially if your name is Kirk.
That's true. I was actually trying to avoid saying his name, I think, because it felt funny to say Kirk and perk.
It's a great Kirk perk.
But also, Kirk, we love that you're doing the math. You know, you mentioned how you felt that it's sort of an oversimplified way of thinking about things. But I feel that's actually not the case. You know, I think this is a great way of looking at things. And we wish that more folks would actually crunch the numbers. But yeah, let's go ahead and get to your question.
All right. So, Matt, let's talk about buying points on a mortgage. And let's kind of define what that means. Buying discount points on a mortgage can be a smart move. And they're different than origination points, which you'll actually want to avoid. But first, let's discuss what these points are, because they can be confusing. 1 point is essentially equal to 1% of the overall amount of the loan. So if you're taking on a $150,000 mortgage, a point's going to cost you $1,500 up front. And because of that discount point, you're paying that money up front right now at closing in order to score a lower rate for the life of your mortgage. So you can see why that might be appealing. If you have money right now and you are going to keep the mortgage a long time, maybe it makes sense for you. But there's even more to think about.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, yeah, paying down points, these points, they represent prepaid interest. And so one of the actual benefits of, you know, paying these points down is the ability to write that off on your taxes as well. You can deduct that versus origination points, which is essentially, you know, the cost of getting that loan to begin with. Because of the standard deduction, most folks aren't itemizing their taxes these days. But if you are, that's definitely something to keep in mind. And Kirk, some other important considerations are going to be how long you plan on living in that home, like Joel kind of mentioned there. And whether or not you are going to have the cash on hand to, you know, actually pay for these points at closing. If you plan on being in the home long term and, you know, you have enough money to purchase those discount points, then it can be a really smart move in order to grab that insanely low rate. The amount of money that you're going to be able to save over the life of that loan is huge, you know, basically earning a 6% compound rate. That's super solid. But if it isn't a home that you plan on being in long term, then you won't actually be getting that rate of return.
Yeah, yeah. If you sell the home after 5 years,
not worth it.
It definitely was not worth buying the points and prepaying that interest. So yeah, so much of it comes down to those things, Matt, like you mentioned, the timing and cash on hand. And if you're focusing on that 6% return on investment, well, then another consideration is whether or not you could potentially take that money that would go to discount points, the $8,000, and invest it elsewhere instead. And some folks might think that 6% return on your money doesn't sound that great, and that they could do better elsewhere in the market, maybe through a real estate investment deal or just investing in the stock market. But the problem is, where the rubber meets the road is, do you have the discipline to take that money and, instead of getting that 6% for sure return on your investment, are you actually going to take that money and invest it instead? And if you have the willpower, if you have the follow through, then investing the money in another way can make sense. But if you don't, or you're not sure, then take the bird in the hand, which is getting that for sure 6% return. That is, if you stay in the home and you keep this mortgage, then pay the discount points and take that for sure 6% return by buying the points ahead of time. I think that's a wise move, especially with the return you're getting by doing it.
Yeah, so Kirk, front loading, you know, this money and paying to get a low rate interest rate, it hasn't always made a ton of sense, you know, but it seems to make particular sense right now, given this, you know, the current state of interest rates for long-term buyers. And so if this is your forever home and, you know, you're likely considering this to be your forever mortgage as well, go ahead, pay those points, lock in that rock bottom rate, as well as that guaranteed ROI on your money. All right, Kirk. Well, thanks so much for that question. And yeah, we wish you the best of luck. All right, Joe, we have a bunch of other questions, including one about credit cards and how to handle money during a divorce. We're going to get to both of those right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. Still taking listener questions, and this one comes from a listener who wants to know about scoring sign-up bonuses for credit cards.
Hey, Joel and Matt. This is Doug from Elgin, Illinois. I have a question regarding episode 14, where you guys are discussing opening credit cards for that one-time bonus. In that podcast, you guys had mentioned that you had a preference of leaving those accounts open, not to close them, and I'm kind of curious why. I do know that having a credit history or a longer credit history is better for your score. So in my case, if I already have 3 or 4 credit cards with, say, 12 to 20 years of history, and I also have a very good credit score over 800, in that case, is it really going to ding me if I'm opening and closing these just to get that one-time bonus? So for example, if I open, say, 10 over the course of a year, do you foresee a score of, say, 820 dropping below 800, or is it smaller in scale? So I'm just kind of curious of why you guys prefer to keep those open in the instance that you already have a long credit history with multiple accounts and you also have built a pretty good score, or if your advice is more specific to the user who hasn't quite built up that history. So if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Doug, thanks so much for your question. And man, you went back to episode 14. I'm glad to hear that we were doling out decent advice back then.
I try not to go back and listen to those episodes.
But the fact is, though, you hit the nail on the head, Doug. You know, the reason we do prefer for folks to keep their cards open and active and not to cancel that card is because of the impact of the age of your credit, which is an important factor in your overall credit score. Closing a card also can have an impact on your utilization rate, which is a major factor in your credit score, too. So if you don't have an abundance of available credit, then canceling that card will ding your score.
Yeah, and so much of the answer to this question, Doug, does hinge on who you are, what your credit score looks like, and what it's made up of. And then how much your score drops depends on some of those things that you mentioned. For folks who have an awesome credit history, a plethora of available credit, like it sounds like you do, canceling a card isn't going to mess that person up in a big way. But if someone opens a card to score a sign-up bonus, but doesn't have other meaningful forms of credit in their mix, it could be really detrimental to that score. For that person, taking out a new card, well, the overall age of their credit history could take a major hit, and their utilization rate could become awful at the same time. So if that happens, that person will see a significant drop in their score. So much of it does depend on your specific circumstances.
And at the same time, it's tough to know exactly, right, how much a score would drop since there are so many variables that are taken into account. But, you know, back to our original point from that old episode, if you have the discipline to not overspend on these additional cards, which it sounds like, you know, you do have that self-control, Doug, then it wouldn't hurt for you to keep these cards open in order to cut your credit utilization rate. You know, otherwise, the only other instance to close it is if they have an annual fee and this isn't a card that you're going to be using on a regular basis.
So I think our advice still holds. We prefer people to, when they open up a credit card, to keep that credit card around as long as they can handle it effectively and pay it off in full every single month. The more credit cards you have in your mix over time, it's actually going to help your credit score. For you in particular, Doug, though, it sounds like you are already so on top of your credit score and you have a pretty deep knowledge of how your credit score works and where it's at. I mean, you're in the 800s. I think 820 is what he said, which is huge. Uh-huh. So closing a card that you haven't had very long isn't going to impact you in a major way. But 10 over the course of a year? That's a lot. I don't
10
know.
Cards, yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's maybe a little aggressive and does stand the chance to ding your credit score in a big way. Also, keep in mind that certain credit card issuers might ban you from opening new cards if you open an account just to score the sign-up bonus and close the card shortly thereafter. If you've done that multiple times, then they could cut you off from access to all of their other credit card offerings. And I guess one of my questions for you too, Doug, is can you even meet the spending limits for 10 cards in 12 months? Like even if you could, that's a big task. It's a lot to keep organized.
I think Doug's up for it though. He seems to be a pretty organized guy.
Okay, all right. I'm just nervous. I think that's a little too aggressive. I think maybe two or three a year to get the sign-up bonus is a decent plan of attack. And I don't think it's going to ding his credit score too much. But I think this strategy could come back to bite Doug.
Yeah, Joel, I agree. For most folks, I think, you know, looking at a few cards a year is easy enough to kind of keep up with. That being said, I think Doug, he's a very organized guy. I resonate with what he's saying there. I like organization, and maybe I've got spreadsheets dedicated to this kind of thing, you know, where you can track everything and make sure that you are making your payments on time, and you want to make sure that you're using your credit wisely. And so, yeah, make sure that you are not biting off more than you can chew.
No doubt. All right, Matt, let's get to our next question. This one comes from a listener who is going through a divorce and has some questions about handling her money in the middle of that.
Hey, guys. This is Marie up in Washington State, and I have some questions about finances after a divorce. Our divorce will be finalized next month, and while assets are minimal, I still don't know what to do with them. I will receive about $15,000 to $20,000 from the sale of a house, and $90,000 from my ex's 401k. My only debt is student loans, but those payments are currently zero as I'm on an income-based repayment plan. My salary just covers expenses for myself and two children who live with me half-time, though I am hoping to add a side hustle soon. I am renting a residence, my car is paid for, but it is 17 years old and has over 200,000 miles on it. I have no liquid savings, but I do have $9,000 in a 401a account through my employer. Like I said, we're not talking a lot of money, but that's all the more reason to be smart with it. I really appreciate your show. I've been listening since the very beginning, and it's been especially helpful as things are rapidly changing, both in my own little world and globally. I really look forward to hearing what you think about my situation. Thanks.
Marie, thanks so much for your question, and we are so sorry to hear about your divorce. You know, this is not only a hard time financially for you, but emotionally as well, and so we certainly feel for you. And so let's go ahead and let's talk about living below your means. You know, that money that you'll be receiving in the divorce settlement is crucial to have in savings for the time being as you get your feet back under you. So set that money aside in a high interest savings account for now, and then focus on tracking your spending. You know, with that information, you can create a budget that makes sense for you, and then hopefully you can begin maybe to cut some of those expenses as well. And so a great goal for you is to not only to continue to cover all of your current expenses, but to be able to start socking some of that money away every single month in order for you to start saving for some of those larger goals that you're going to have down the road.
Yeah, including the possibility of having student loan payments again if your income were to increase.
Exactly.
Right? You want to be ready for that in case that happens. Let's cover a few more things. It's really important to keep that old car for a couple more years. That should be a really big goal of yours too, in order to avoid adding another expense into your life as your life is experiencing, like you mentioned, just a lot of changes right now. Even though it's got over 200,000 miles, I mean,
which is awesome, by the way.
Which is great. That's what we're all shooting for, right?
I think for real, car goals should be having a car with over 200,000 miles that's at least 17 years old. I like everything about Marie's car.
Yeah,
and it's paid for.
Right? Yeah. Which I mean, you can't do better than that. And so yeah, instead of using that cash to buy a nicer car to get around, keep depending on the car that you currently have, and then keep cash around for the inevitable replacement that's going to be necessary, but hopefully not for a few years down the road. There's a time also for prioritizing retirement investing, but I'd say now is not that time for you, Marie. When you're undergoing a major life change, it's totally okay to take that off the table right now and not feel compelled to be contributing in a major way to your work retirement plan or to, you know, an IRA. Obviously, Matt and I, we talk about those things a lot. We do think they're important, but it's okay to take 3 or 6 months of investing off the table for now as you're kind of getting your bearings. And also, too, you shouldn't need to tap your retirement for anything since you do have that settlement coming in, the over $100,000 that's going to be coming into your life. So we would say that's another thing is a lot of people in a sticky situation like yours, a sticky financial situation, will tap retirement accounts and then they'll have tax consequences associated with it. Not to mention the fact that they're raiding their future nest egg to use now. And we would say it sounds like you're in a good enough situation where you're not going to have to do that. And we would encourage you to refrain from touching retirement accounts to use them now.
And a few other points of financial housekeeping, you know, a few other things to consider if you haven't already. It is really important now to close any joint credit accounts that are in both of your names. You don't want any poor usage of credit done by your partner to be showing up on your credit report. And then on that note, make sure that you have credit that is in your name and your name only as well. That's to help with your credit score, though. You know, this isn't to rack up any debt. We don't want that there for you to necessarily have to fall back on that. Also, too, you'll need to open up your own bank account if you don't already have one. You know, we mentioned earlier about socking that possibly over $100,000 into a high interest savings account. We love online banks, you know, like Ally, Discover, and CIT. There's other great no fee options out there for you as well. And then one final note too, it's important to change your beneficiary on any retirement accounts as well as life insurance if you have those set up, and even creating a new will. Not all of these are necessarily going to be fun to do. I feel like calling these housekeeping or just kind of financial chores is maybe the right way to think about it, because Nobody really likes to do these things. Nobody enjoys doing them, but they are good things to do in order to get your financial house in shape.
Yeah, for sure. All those things that you mentioned, Matt, so important right now for Marie to tackle in the near future. And Marie, there are a lot of changes happening right now. I can't imagine going through what you're going through kind of in the midst of what we're all collectively going through. It's a weird time. So we would suggest just taking it one day at a time. And even when it comes to the financial chores Matt mentioned, one day at a time, right? Try to tackle one thing. And because I think it can become overwhelming when you hear a laundry list and then you're like, oh, yeah. And so, yeah.
As I was saying all those things, I kind of felt bad.
take one thing at a time. And also too, I think it's really important to take some time to explore your own personal financial goals. That will help to direct the actions that you're taking now moving forward. You don't want to rush any large financial decisions either. I hope you've also got people around you that love you and have your back, and that you can be a sounding board for you in this time, both financially and personally. So yeah, Marie, we wish you the best. All right, Matt, we got a couple more questions to get to, including a question from a school teacher who eventually wants to live on a school bus. We'll get to those right after the break.
All right, Joel, we are back from the break taking listener questions. And before we get to that school bus question, we have one about investment apps. Let's go ahead and get to that one.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Joe from Northwest Arkansas. Thank you both for doing a great job of making everyday personal finance understandable and interesting. I've been looking for a spare change investing app, which rounds up transactions on your credit card and automatically saves or invests the difference. There seem to be several good-looking options out there, like Acorns, Robinhood, Wealthfront, Betterment, or others. I already have a Fidelity personal investment account, which I am not looking to replace. I'm looking more for something that's simple to use and will just help me save some extra money over time. So I would love to hear your thoughts on which of these apps you think is the best for everyday use, and specifically which has the best fee structure, as I imagine fees can make a big difference when you're talking about investing such a small amount every month. By the way, Northwest Arkansas has some of the best cycling in the country, and there are a ton of great craft breweries around. So if you're ever in the area, please give me a shout. Thanks a lot.
Ooh, biking in Arkansas and beers too?
Bikes and beers, baby.
I'm in, Joe.
Those are all of our favorite things.
I'm hopping in my car now. But first, we'll answer your question. All right. So yeah, let's talk about the investing accounts that round up. First, spare change investing apps are pretty cool, and they're a major part of the democratization of investing, which has really occurred over the last 10 years. It's become so much easier for individual investors to invest just a little bit here and there. And that's made investing, I would say, relevant, simple, and inexpensive for almost everybody who wants to participate. And these apps in particular, they tap into something that you touched on, Joe. Often, it's our own behavior that gets in the way of us being able to invest more of our money. Having an intelligent app that does it for us on the reg helps many of us invest consistently when we otherwise might not have.
Yeah, and you mentioned some good specific options there, Joe, but you know, M1, that's our favorite, you know, of all the different investing apps, but they don't have the rounding up approach, you know, that you're looking for. And so the big ones there in that space are Stash and Acorns. You can start investing via Acorns Lite for only $1 a month. You know, that's not too bad. That money will go into a brokerage account, though, not a retirement account like an IRA, which, you know, that would be best for your taxes, you know, from a tax standpoint. The Stash Beginner account does essentially the same thing. You know, it's just $1. And although, you know, that fee, right, of $1, it's not ideal. It's not bad if it actually gets you to invest when you otherwise might not. You know, it kind of comes down to that behavior side of things. But then on the contrary, I'm going to give another argument, which is that, you know, $1, it may not seem that bad, but it all depends too on how much you're investing, right? And so if you say you only have $10 in that account and you have a $1 fee, well, that's 10%. In a fund or an account, we know, with a 10% expense ratio would not be something we would ever recommend.
Right.
And so, you know, on one hand, it feels real small because if that gets you to invest maybe more than you normally would, then it's a good thing. However, if you're comparing it to a traditional low cost brokerage house who doesn't charge you anything, and then on top of that, their funds are pretty low cost, then that's when Stash or Acorns might not be a great idea.
Yeah. And Matt, you just mentioned the two cheapest versions of Stash and Acorns, but it gets more expensive from there.
$3, $9.
Yeah. And so especially, yeah, if you want to open up a retirement account through both of those companies, you can. It's just going to cost you more every single month. And so, Joe, what we would say is you basically have an account with one of the best, most awesome low-cost companies out there, Fidelity. And so the absolute best move for you fee-wise is to have a monthly automatic contribution to your IRA there. The fees are non-existent if you go with one of the Fidelity Zero funds, and you can easily invest inside of a retirement account, a traditional or a Roth IRA there, giving you tax benefits at the same time. So, Matt and I, what we would say is if you need the behavioral help, like if you're not going to invest it any other way, you're just going to avoid it, then go with Acorns or Stash, pay the fee, and get more money set aside for your future. But if that's not the case, if you're a pretty dedicated investor, then forego those rounding up apps, we would say, and pop more money in your retirement account via the company you already have a relationship with. Get those automatic withdrawals set up on a recurring monthly or weekly basis that make it part of the norm, where those things basically become just a regular debit from your account consistently.
Yeah, those recurring auto deposits, you know, like that's when you're going to be able to make a meaningful, you know, impact on your retirement accounts. You know, if you're counting on rounding up apps for your retirement, I don't know how much headway you're actually going to make just by, you know, with some change. And so I think that might be a good question to ask yourself is, what are you going to be using these apps for? If you're counting on it for retirement, then maybe not. But if you're looking to use these apps for setting maybe smaller, more near-term goals, like saving up for a vacation or saving up, you know, for a car or something like that, I think those are great examples of when something like Acorns or Stash, where they would make a ton of sense, because it's a lot easier to maybe round up a buck or two and have that go towards, you know, something that's going to cost you a couple $1,000s. That just feels more attainable to me versus the need to set aside a couple $100,000s, you know, like that.
Or even $1,000,000.
Exactly. And so, yeah, if you're looking to use an app like this for some of those short-term goals, I think it could definitely make a lot of sense for you.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, Joe, best of luck to you, man, in your investing endeavors. And it sounds like you're on the right path. And yeah, figuring out that behavioral side is so crucial for all of us so that we can become dedicated investors for the long haul. All right, next question, Matt. This one comes from a school teacher who wants to live in a school bus, and I'm so excited to take this question.
Hi, Matt and Joel. I'm Becky from Kansas City. I'm a single mom. My kids are now grown and out of the house. I'll retire in 10 years at the age of 57. I currently live in an apartment, which I love because I don't have to do any maintenance or lawn care. After I retire from teaching, I'd like to live in a converted school bus and travel the country. I don't have any interest in home ownership, but I keep hearing the message that home ownership is the best path to wealth building. Should I buy property I don't really want for the potential financial gain? Is there another way to get the same rate of return? Thank you so much for a great show. Take care.
Jill, how cool is that? She's a teacher, and now she wants to live in a school bus. It's like full circle.
I know. It's so great. It's so great.
You know, it reminds me of, did you ever play Cruisin' USA? Have we talked about that on the show before?
I mean, oh yeah, I played
Cruisin'
USA.
It's an old arcade game, but you could also play it on the N64. And I remember somehow you could like put a special code in, like maybe get a cheat code or something like that, and you could race as a school bus instead of like a Ferrari or a Corvette or something like that.
You think Becky's going to be racing her school bus someday or not? Probably just living in it.
I think so. Popping wheelies.
Exploring the country. That sounds awesome. So yeah, Becky, I appreciate what you're all about. You sound awesome, and your dream sounds really great too. Also, congrats on being able to retire at 57.
Yeah, 10 years from now. That's going to be awesome.
Right. That's incredible as well. And at the same time, Matt, I mean, one of the cool things about the converted school bus is that the cost of living isn't really going to be all that much either. So maybe that makes it possible for Becky to retire at that age. Retiring to a cheap lifestyle can allow you to retire earlier than maybe you previously thought.
And she might even argue that this isn't a cheap way to live, but maybe a more affordable way to live a very rich life on the road, seeing all that she wants to see.
Frugal, not cheap. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So specifically, Becky, let's get to your question on whether home ownership is necessary in wealth building. And Matt and I, we would say that the answer is a definite no on this one. Home ownership is certainly not the best path to wealth building for most people. It's just actually the path that most people take.
Yeah.
So in fact, I think Matt, you mentioned this on a recent episode, a predominance of net worth is in home equity for most Americans. Yeah, we talked about that on our net worth episode.
That's right.
A lot of people who have a decent net worth, it's not because they've done a good job of saving and investing, it's because they've lived in a home over a certain period of time and they've accrued some equity there. And we actually don't think that's great. We'd prefer to see you investing in something like a target retirement fund over the next 10 years while you're still working and building wealth that way as opposed to putting it into a home. Plus, think about the logistics, Matt, of being a long-distance landlord from your wandering school bus, from your nomadic adventures, right? There's not only the maintenance cost, but also the time that it takes. I would think it'd be a bit of a headache to manage a property from afar.
Oh, geez. And plus, she even mentioned too in her question that she loves not having to worry about the yard, not having to worry about maintenance. And so I tell you what, if you don't enjoy those things on your own home that you personally live in, it's even less fun to do it in a property that you manage that's an investment property.
Yeah, that's true.
But let's talk about the historic returns of actual real estate, right? The median home value in the U.S. has increased at 5.5% since 1940. And that's not bad, but the annual return of investing in stocks is over 9%. And even a balanced portfolio of 60% stocks and 40% bonds has a historical return of 7.8%. And so the numbers certainly reflect that investing in the American economy is better than investing in a physical home. Plus, you'll never have to replace a roof or an HVAC unit on one of your index funds, right?
And if Vanguard comes calling me and they ask for a roof replacement, I'm gonna hang up the phone.
Yeah, like a surprise capital expense that they try to pin to you? No way, man.
No way. Not any day. Not having it.
And then Becky, too, back in episode 30, we actually compared home ownership to investing in the market. And in that episode, we laid out all the different reasons why investing in the market is so much better. So if you haven't yet listened to that episode, we would highly recommend that one. If you are not already convinced to not buy property, Becky, you will be after listening to that one.
So Becky, that also might beg the question, why do Matt and I invest in real estate? Are we gluttons for punishment?
How
are we idiots?
Hold both of these things at the same time, because we truly do believe that for most folks, like investing in the market is the best option.
Yeah.
However,
yeah, but investing in real estate can make sense for a lot of people, especially people that are attracted to it and do their due diligence. And also if it fits within their lifestyle, which it sounds like, Becky, for you, for multiple reasons. One, because you're not interested in it. And two, you're planning on living an ultra nomadic lifestyle. Like, it's just not going to fit into your plans. But it is possible to invest in real estate and outperform the historic numbers that Matt just mentioned, because certain local real estate markets allow investors specific opportunities. Basically, you're talking about a much smaller market with interesting little inefficiencies that can pop up from time to time. And so the deals that you can find when you're investing in property can be meaningful, and they can make real estate just a really great asset if you're interested in that being part of your life.
Yeah, exactly, man. And I will say too, that episode I referenced, right? Episode 30, about how your home isn't you know, an awful investment, we're also specifically talking about primary residences. And when we buy real estate, you know, when we're looking at real estate, we're looking at it through a completely different lens as compared to how most folks are looking at property to purchase, you know, for a home. And so
yeah, they want to live in as a primary residence.
Yeah.
It's a different set of factors that you're weighing. And people choose a home to live in for many different reasons than they would choose a home to rent or a home to buy to rent out to tenants.
Yeah, so Becky, I think the biggest consideration here in your question is lifestyle. And it doesn't sound like that this is something that you personally want to do. It sounds like you want to hit the road. And in your case, we would recommend avoiding real estate completely and instead focusing on the market, investing in the stock market.
Keep it simple. The simplicity factor matters so much for investors too, right? And in your case, Becky, simplicity is a major concern as well. And so taking the simple route of investing in something like a target date retirement fund makes just a whole lot more sense for you and your situation.
Exactly. All right. So now that we've talked Becky out of buying any real estate, let's talk about our beer, Joel. This episode, you and I, we enjoyed a Swoon Units. And this is a, I'm going to read what it says here on the label. It says, it's a quenchable and crushable fruit beer with local blackberries. And this is by Fonta Flora Brewery up in North Carolina. This is one of those breweries that you and I love a lot. And neither of us have ever been there, but we're going to have to remedy that soon, man. What were your thoughts on this beer?
Yeah, so most fruit beers, I think, are usually tart, and this one wasn't. And so it was kind of nice to drink something a little bit different, off the beaten path. It had a very like earthy vibe to it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and I appreciated something just kind of out of left field, which it totally felt like this one was.
Yeah, when we poured it, it had a nice burgundy kind of matte, velvety, like red color to it. But I was also surprised, Joel, like you were, that, you know, this was not a sour beer. So because of that, I felt you could almost even focus on some of the fruit a little bit more. Certainly the blackberries, and almost felt like it almost had this kind of grape-like flavor.
Oh,
you
they
know?
Stink some grapes in there? I didn't even notice.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, it says fruit, you know, so maybe there's other fruit in there as well. So yeah, man, this was an enjoyable fruit ale that I'm glad you and I got to share with each other. It's certainly a good change of pace, you know, because oftentimes we gravitate towards New England IPAs or fruited sours or barrel-aged stouts. But it's nice to have something a little bit different here to kind of mix it up on the show.
Yeah, very unique. And that's what Fauna Flora does. It seems like a lot of unique beers coming out of that brewery. So it was a pleasure to get to have this one with you, my friend. All right, that's going to do it for today's episode. For folks who want show notes for this episode, just go to our website at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, and if you're listening to our show for the first time and you have not yet subscribed, you can easily do that by mashing that button there on your phone to make sure that you don't miss a single episode. And if you haven't left us a review yet either, we would love it if you were to head over to Apple Podcasts, where you can leave us a solid review over there. It helps us to get the word out to those looking how to manage their money a little bit better. So Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.